Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with My Opel, rewarding loyalty and taking care of members.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Time now for our gathering. We're going to discuss all the big stories of the week. I'm joined in studio by Roisin Shortall, co-leader of the Social Democrats, Aoife McGlaisett, professor of genetics in Trinity College Dublin and a member of the Independent Scientific Advisory Group, Christina Finn, political correspondent with the Journal.ie, and Martin Hayden, Minister of State at the Department of Agriculture and Fine Gael TD for Kildare South. Excuse me. First, a little bit of confusion to clear up, though. The Licensed Vintners Association, which represents pubs in Dublin, tweeted this morning, lots of queries coming in this morning about the nightclub guidelines. We don't have them as of yet, and they haven't been published. As soon as they are, we will make them available. Well, the Music and Entertainment Association has also been in touch on this morning to raise the same issue. We have asked the department about it, and a spokesperson for Minister Catherine Martin told us the guidelines are being finalised and will then be published. I'm joined on the line by Jackie Conboy from the MEAI. Jackie, I thought that this was all sorted, didn't you?
Well, you know, we were kind of jumping up in the air and delighted that it was a major step forward and that it was, it's been long awaited, and now suddenly there's a delay, and we thought that the guidelines were going to be published this morning because we were given the guidelines yesterday at the meeting. And then that we were asked to kind of distribute it amongst, venues
and
whatever.
Do you think that there's going to be any changes to what is now going to be finalised and published, any significant changes?
Well, that's the worrying part. Now, again, this is going to cause serious stress again because venues are trying to get ready to open up and they need these guidelines to be sure that they're going to be within the letter of the law. So again, here, it's going to be another last minute thing again, and we don't know what to expect. We don't know what's going on. We thought we were going to wake up this morning with the whole thing published and it was going to be online and everyone was going to have a 73-page document.
T-minus 12 hours and 25 minutes and counting to your reopening. I mean, can you realistically pivot and turn around and absorb any major changes?
Well, look, we have no choice, but the one thing that's very important here and is for the public, you know, to give everyone in venues and that a chance and give the staff a chance. And it's all about self-responsibility here that, you know, it has to be highlighted. It's going to be very difficult for the industry to get up and running now. And this is the biggest weekend of the year. So we've been pushed into a major, major hotspot now.
All right, Jackie, thank you very much. Minister Martin Hayden, how hard can this be? Work out the details first, announce the policy second.
Yeah, and Philip, in an ideal world, we'd have all the time in the world to plan these things, but COVID is an evolving situation. Government received...
You had a very long lead into October 22nd.
But the situation is evolving. Maybe you disagree with that, but like, government received NPHET advice on Monday evening. NPHET asked for the extra few days to wait till Monday to make sure they were working off the most recent advice. The COVID situation has changed significantly.
You had rising
in the last
case
2 weeks.
Numbers for a fortnight.
Yeah, but and again, that's evolving, and we have our modelling out there, and we're trying to look. This is not ideal, and I know these businesses have been closed for 500 and 600 days. The nightclubs that are reopening tonight, and this is not an ideal situation anyone would like to be in. Minister Martin last night outlined the agreement, but obviously you have to underpin these with the guidelines that are written. And my understanding is they'll be published very shortly, and you would prefer if this was done much earlier. But we're reacting as quick as we can to public health advice.
Why not do the simple and obvious thing then and say, folks, we need another week to get the right guidelines in place instead of this cart before the horse ad hocery?
No, so I don't believe it's cart before the horse. Like, there's two things that are probably the easiest thing for government to do. One is to have everything closed, and one is to have everything open. And then anywhere in between, you have anomalies, you have challenges, you have contradictions, and that is hard for us. And we have to navigate through them. But I don't think any of those businesses that are working today to get open tonight while they're frustrated with getting the advice late, I don't think any of them want to be closed this weekend. It is the bank holiday weekend. I think they want to have that ability to reopen and to work and to do so in a safe way for their staff and for their customers, but to get back open. And we want to facilitate that. And that's
okay. Roisin Shortall, it is a very fluid and dynamic evolving situation. We cannot let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
It is evolving, there's no doubt about that. But we have known for almost 3 weeks now that the case numbers were going absolutely in the wrong direction. And they continued on that trajectory. And, you know, it's been made very clear by NPHET. They said that since early October, case counts are following the pessimistic scenario. And we have all that flows from that then in terms of the predictions of a doubling of the numbers in hospital that are likely by late November, a doubling of the numbers in ICU. So all of this is set out in the modelling. Now, you know, you'd have to wonder why this now is all last minute stuff to open the nightclubs tonight. Work should have been done, and there's an attitude there on the part of government that, you know, this is all at arm's length. We're keeping it at arm's length from us. It's all about personal responsibility. There are lots of things that are nothing to do with personal responsibility, and that is in terms of setting standards for a whole lot of things. Standards in relation to enforcement, standards in relation to ventilation, standards in relation to testing, to antigen testing, standards in relation to masks. And the government just has washed its hands of all responsibility in relation to that. Yes, of course, we all have to individually behave responsibly and be careful. But like, there's lots of things that the individual can't do. It's up to government to set standards. And, you know, we're now in a situation where, you know, things are opening up tonight. Full numbers, 100%. And we're talking about people queuing for drinks at a bar and being socially distanced. I mean, this stuff is nonsense, really.
But if you want to talk about nonsense, Roisin...
Sorry, just a moment. You're putting businesses in a dreadful situation where just a matter of hours before they're due to open and they're required to open safely, they haven't even got the guidelines. So, I mean, you just haven't got your act together on a whole lot of things. You need to start...
I disagree with that, and it is easy from opposition to make it sound like everything is simple for government to do.
And decisions we take, we
have to make sure follow through. Look, in opposition, you can, as you did earlier this year, call for zero COVID, issue, write opinion pieces about that. If that was the case, we wouldn't have restaurants and bars open now.
That's completely untrue.
But hold on. In opposition, you're able to completely flip from a very strong position of zero COVID one month to a different position another month. We got criticised on vaccine passports, which allowed us to open back up.
I'm happy to deal with that if you want me to, because we had a situation before the vaccines were available where, you know, we were importing high numbers of COVID cases into this country. And what we were arguing was that you needed to take steps to stop
If
that.
Government had followed zero COVID's advice, we would have been in an absolute mess. And the people who got
the businesses that got opened back up, in opposition, you're able to change your position. Government doesn't have that luxury. You seem to be ignoring the fact that this country has paid a massive price for the handling of COVID in this country. Last year, you know, 5,000 people died. Hundreds of thousands of people lost their jobs.
Look at what
has happened in relation to the economy. Now, there were different ways to handle that, but I'm not getting into the blame game now, but there were better ways of handling it. And you can look at other countries who handled it better. But we are in the situation that we're in now. And thankfully, you know, there are vaccines available. The vaccine programme has been very successful, though, unfortunately, there's breakthrough. And that's why that you cannot depend solely on the vaccinations.
Okay, let me bring in.
We accept that.
And just you need to deal with all of the other mitigating factors which you actually haven't been dealing with.
Let me bring in Christina Finn, political correspondent here. Are government in any way embarrassed, do you think, Christina, that here we are once again announcing policy before we've worked out the details?
Well, I don't think this is the first time that it's happened, so I'm not sure how embarrassed they're actually going to be, because this has happened time and time again throughout. I think the lifting of restrictions, it really never ceases to amaze me how we come down to the wire with these things. We've had no preemptive planning, no contingency planning. Why somebody in the department wasn't sitting down with vintners nightclubs over the last number of months and putting together a plan A, plan B, plan C, depending on where we are hitting the numbers come the 22nd. I think a lot of people will be scratching scratching their heads. The vintners coming out today saying they're waiting those guidelines before they even open this evening, because I think it comes down to, throughout the lifting of these regulations, and I've always argued this, is that it's people who perhaps don't understand the industry that they're dealing with. They perhaps are older people that aren't heading out into the nightclubs or to coppers and all the rest, and actually have been on the ground in the nightclub in the past 20 years. We had the same thing with the 11:30 close that's only been lifting now. Time and time again, people have said that young people throughout the last year were leaving pubs and venues and going back to people's houses, which is exactly what we were told not to do, but that was the reality on the ground. So I'm not sure how embarrassed they're going to be. I can understand how businesses now are, you know, it's going to leave a bad taste in their mouth in terms of going forward with this government and, you know, how they looked after them through this whole event.
Aoife McLeish says, given that we're now in a situation where COVID certs seem to be being honoured more in the breach than the observance, where we have kind of mothballed contact tracing, that we're really relying pretty much, as Roisin was saying, almost exclusively on the vaccine as our line of protection between us and the virus. Are you worried that we have what appears to be a single-pronged strategy, or putting all of our eggs in one basket?
Yeah, we've been doing that, I think, consistently since the beginning. In the beginning, the government relied exclusively on lockdowns. Then when the vaccine came along, our policy was clearly wait for the vaccine and depend on the vaccine. And without doing all the other things that we should have been doing, you know, it's really disappointing that the government is caught by surprise this week, because they should have seen this coming. They shouldn't have stopped contact tracing in schools, for example, because that has been a significant factor. The spread when schools came back went unnoticed because we closed our eyes to it. We should have been more aware that this was coming. And we shouldn't be scrambling at the last minute to, you know, start talking about antigen testing now. We've known for over a year that this is an airborne virus, that this is caught through unclean air, shared air. And the thing that we really need is we need proper standards for these places to open so that they can decide the number of people who can go into a venue based on what is the air quality and what's the ventilation standards, not on whether it's a live music gig or a DJ gig, or whether it's a cinema, or whether you're having a meal with your drink or not. And these kind of nonsense kind of measures that we've had all the way. So we need to think about all the different things we can do. And so the three broad prongs that we should have are prevention, vaccination and control. So vaccination, we've done really, really well on. We haven't done well on prevention, and we haven't done well on control. Control covers all of the public health and testing and tracing and all of that.
Martin Hayden, it is a war that you could be fighting on so many more fronts, on ventilation and so on, other things that aren't intrusive, that don't disrupt people's lives, yet you're choosing to fight this war on one front, with vaccinations.
No, I don't agree with that. We're moving to a space where obviously we have to live with COVID, you know, and the vaccinations has been a key part to that. But we still need to have much of our safety measures in place to address the concerns that Aoife has outlined there. And you know, we will have a winter where, you know, COVID is a reality for us. And whether that's in, you know, the partial return to work, whether it's in some of the hospitality sectors, we need to have, you know, an approach that is mindful of the risk. And that, but, you know, I would just pick up maybe Roisin on one point earlier, that where she said, like, I know you're making a point, there are some things that are not personal responsibility, but in saying that, it makes it sound like there's no personal responsibility.
No, I
and there is, I know you didn't say it,
yeah,
but I'm just saying.
Don't misrepresent.
No, I'm not misrepresenting it. I didn't say you said it. I'm just saying it could be the inference is taken. And I do think it's important to say here that we do all have a personal responsibility in how we, you know, carry out our lives and mitigate the risks that are out there for us.
We don't have equal opportunity to exercise personal responsibility, though. The school children don't have any opportunity to exercise personal responsibility going into their school. They can't decide not to go there. Parents can't decide not to send them without getting some kind of repercussions. An employee can't take personal responsibility that their place of work is not adequately ventilated and they'll choose to stay at home. There's massive consequences for people to do that. There's even consequences for people who decide to isolate because of symptoms, because in a lot of cases that's going to result in loss of income. So there are lots and lots of ways in which personal responsibility is not actually available. And there are ways that that could be remedied. You know, so we don't ask people to take responsibility for the food hygiene in a restaurant they go to. This is taken care of invisibly in the background. air hygiene needs to be treated the same way.
Christina Finn, are we any wiser at this end of the week as to why it is that the Department of Education overruled the Board of Governors of the CBS primary school in Wexford, who seemed to be doing the responsible thing?
No, there's been a bit of back and forth, I think, between Norma Foley over the last number of days in relation to the contact tracing for children. It's obviously an issue that parents and principals have been highlighting for weeks now. But time and time again, I think that the Department of Education have said that schools are a safe environment and all the protocols are in place. But I think teachers on the ground, ones that I know themselves, are saying that, you know, pods and all the rest are one thing on a piece of paper, but it's very different when you're in a classroom with young children who just don't understand, as you were saying, the personal responsibility aspect. They just want to hang out with their friends. They might be with their friends in the pod 1 minute and out in the yard the next, rolling around on the grass. So I think it's something that the department has obviously probably will have to have a look at now, seeing as there are definitely concerns among the closure of schools happening in the last week or so.
Martin Hayden, it's not your brief, so I'll accept that you might not know the details of it intimately, but do you understand why it is that for the sake of what appeared to be just 1.5 days schooling, the possibility for a proper break in the transmission of the virus was surrendered in Wexford just for the principle of putting kids back into school again?
So, look, it's not my direct area of responsibility, but maybe I've answered from the point of view that I have young children at home, some of whom are in primary school, and I know how hard it's been for parents and for teachers since schools returned in September. You know, when the coughs and sniffles and colds that come about as a normal return to schools, and we have another child in a creche, and all the pressures that brings makes it difficult.
But I know, but schools are not a childcare venue. They shouldn't be used as a place where parents can put their children.
No,
because the disruption to their education would be even greater if the entire school ends up coming down with the virus.
No, absolutely. But we're talking here about confusion. We're talking here about not having the clarity for certain sectors that we would like to have as quickly as possible. If we have individual schools, boards of management in general, I'm not specifically talking about Wexford, but I'm in general, if we have every single board of management making unilateral decisions, then I think that is a very dangerous space for us to be in, because you would have individual schools, boards of management who aren't, you know, medical experts, making decisions based on their feeling or on the feelings of certain parents or certain staff. And there has to be a more uniform approach to that. So, you know, I'm absolutely open to the points that have been made here in terms of, obviously we have the midterm break now starting today, and I've no doubt NPHET are continuing to monitor the impact in our
schools. Roisin Shortall, the department knows best.
Well, look, we heard that principal from the CBS in Wexford on the radio during the week. She had a very difficult situation to deal with.
I don't underestimate that.
And she made the point, you know, that since the contact tracing had stopped for close contacts in the schools, and since they were advised not to inform parents if there were cases of COVID in the class, and it's just impossible to understand the thinking behind that. What was she supposed to do in a situation where a high number of children in the school had COVID, had been diagnosed with it? And she, along with her board of management, took the decision which she believed was in the interests of children, the teachers, and also the families, because children were obviously bringing COVID home and infecting their families and others that they met. So she was left to take that decision with her board of management. And she made it very clear that there was very little guidance available from public health to her in that situation. She did what she thought was best. And then, you know, the department told her to.
Indeed, the guidance actually was, in an awful lot of instances, these decisions are best made locally.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And they had been made locally with the advice of public health doctors, but that has stopped now.
And look, that local public health advice does need to be there, part of that. And I accept that that principal, I don't want to make this personal about that school, made that decision in the right point. I'll make a broader point, though. If we had individual schools, the length and breadth of the country, opening and closing day in, day out, we'd be having a very different conversation here, Roisin. And in opposition, you would be attacking government.
That's very mistrustful of the school boards. I think they're trying to protect the access to education.
Of course, and I'm not undermining that, and I know how hard it is for volunteers on a board of management of a school board. I've been on boards of management myself as well, as I'm sure Roisin has too. It's a really challenging space to be in. I accept that, but do you accept my point here that if individual schools, the length and breadth of the country, thousands of schools were all acting unilaterally?
But that would happen in the absence of guidance. and from public health. I just ask you as a parent then, if in one of your children's classes, you know, there were six children with COVID, do you think you should be told about that?
Like, I would
so
say
that you can take proper precautions, and it may be the case that you have a person with an underlying condition at home who is very vulnerable. Shouldn't you be entitled to that information?
I would say there was COVID in some of my children's classes previously, and it was a case that, you know, the pod system there did work. And I bring you back to Tony Hoolan's point that and the NPHET advice, that schools, yes, of course, there's more transmission in the community. That will then manifest itself more in the schools, but schools in themselves are safe.
I want to move the conversation.
There's other studies showing the opposite.
So you don't want to follow NPHET advice then?
I'd like to move the conversation on, if we can, please.
Easy to do that in opposition.
I'd like to move the conversation on, if we can, please, to yesterday's commemoration of the partition of Ireland or creation of Northern Ireland, delete as you feel appropriate. Martin, Jim O'Callaghan, Fianna Fáil TD Jim O'Callaghan, was on BBC last night saying how Fianna Fáil had never been very enthusiastic about this commemoration at all. So do we take it then that it was basically a Fine Gael decision for the government to attend?
No, Philip. No, that's... Look, this is a church-led event. You know, it wasn't a celebration. And I think some of the comments that were made from the altar yesterday about the damage of partition were particularly stark. I think government made the decision that the line minister and the government chief whip would attend, and I think that was appropriate.
Okay, but Fianna Fáil were, well, according to Jim O'Callaghan anyway, holding their noses over this.
Look, you know, anything to do with partition in this island is extremely sensitive issue, and a lot of members of all parties, including my own, would have had viewpoints on how we mark anything to do with partition, and would have very strong views that it's a very sensitive area for us to be in. But, you know, government makes a collective decision, and that very much was the case, that it was a collective decision. And I think in light of how yesterday went and the fact that, you know, it was a church-led service, and that the comments out there, you know, really reflected on the damage that partition has done to our country, reflects that it was appropriate that government was represented at it.
Roisin, it was all very kumbaya and holding of hands and really very hard to take offence at. I mean, you would have to go a long way out of your way to be offended by what happened in that church yesterday.
Look, I think this is the thing that media commentators are, you know, very involved in. I think the general public were quite happy with the decision that was taken by the president. And the attendance at commemorative events anyway should be discretionary. Mm.
But the point that I'm making to you is that maybe the 68% of the Irish public who supported President Higgins in his decision might now want to revisit it in the light of what actually happened in that church yesterday.
Well, I don't know if that's the case. First of all, it was only churches. There's lots of non-Christian and multi-denominational kind of interests in the north. And I think it was strange that they weren't involved at all. But, you know, the decision was taken by the president, and I fully respected that, and I agreed with the position he took. I mean, the opposite, say, down here would be a commemoration of 1916. Arlene Foster didn't attend that. And I think we all understood why she didn't attend. And likewise, most of us understood why Michael Dee didn't want to go to Armagh. And, you know, that's fine. And I think that's fine with everybody. And the event is over now. And I think we should stop talking about it, to be honest with you.
Christina Finn, should we stop talking about it? Can we stop talking about it?
Yeah, well, I think I would kind of agree. I think that the president made the right decision there. It comes down to really what he represents and his role. And, you know, going back over years, if you've stopped into the National Archives and looked at those 30-year, you know, records that are released, there's always back and forth between the president and, say, the Department of Foreign Affairs over issues like this and what is right and, you know, what should be attended to and what events are appropriate for him to go to. I thought it was interesting that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael seemed to, you know, hold to trying to balance it out by having Jack Chambers and Simon Coveney there. So neither party was sort of getting off the hook in terms of getting to that event. Yesterday it was, you know, rather a sombre event. I don't think really anyone could have taken any offence, but I do think people kind of do respect the president's position on it, and I suppose what he represents in his role, and perhaps him maybe making the choice that it wasn't appropriate for him to be there at that time.
Eva McLeish said, what's the scientist's view of something like this? Because you don't get to pick and choose the viewpoints that you want to at least familiarise yourselves with. You have to consider everything, don't you?
Yeah. I think this doesn't really have a scientific viewpoint.
I'm reaching, am I? I'm going too far. All right. Let us get into something much, much more scientific, though. Martin Hayden, this speaks directly to your brief in the Department of Agriculture. We've had very recently the new head of the agricultural advisory body, Chagas, coming out and saying that expansion of the dairy sector had been fantastic and would continue. And we have at the same time Laura Burke, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, saying that expansion of the dairy sector must stop. It's really hard to think of an example of two agencies of government holding two more diametrically opposed points of view. Who's right?
So my department, Department of Agriculture, and I'm very proud of the fact that we were the first state department to produce our roadmap for how we will lower the emissions from the agriculture sector and our food production sector, but while also embodying that with our food vision approach for 2030, which is about sustainability, not just of the environment, but the sustainability of farmers' incomes and the rural communities in which they live.
Can I interrupt you from your text and get you to answer my question?
Well, not from a text. I'm looking straight at you.
Okay, well, memorised text, and you've done a good job of it. Who's...
No, I'm passionate about this. I'm passionate.
Who's right? Because both Frank O'Mara and Laura Burke's point of view cannot be accommodated in the same policy.
So to finish my point, Ag Climatise is based on a stable herd. And it is doing that. And the decisions that agriculture will make, and we will play our role in terms of reducing our overall emissions with other sectors of society in a very ambitious climate action plan here. But we will do that while protecting our food producing industry that's so important to our rural economy. And also, it'll be based on science. There's a lazy narrative developing, largely in urban areas and across media in different places, that reducing the herd will solve all of our problems. And Philip, I fundamentally disagree with that. We have science-based, we have farmers on a journey already. We have farmers choosing genetically...
We have all sorts of efficiencies that are being introduced on farms and have been for a number of years. Yet the report from the EPA this morning says that those figures continue to go up. Martin, we haven't even met our 2020 targets yet, and it's the arse end of 2022.
So, Philip, if you look at the slight increase there was in agriculture emissions last year, obviously most of society in Ireland reduced due to the fact that they were impacted by COVID. Agriculture wasn't, agricultural production continued, but there was a slight variance increase compared to a 4% drop of the year before. But if you talk about the contributing factors to that, like the use of artificial nitrogen and fertiliser, we are on a trajectory of using protected measures like protected urea, multi-species swards, the introduction of more clover into our pasture-based system that will reduce that, as well as feed additives down the line.
I know.
Agriculture has a role to play. But if you're
relying
on that,
if
the farmer isn't the victim.
I'm not suggesting that he is, but if you rely solely on efficiencies, it means that you're asking all of the other sectors of our society to carry more weight.
It's not just on efficiencies, but it's on science. Our approach is based on science and not some idealism that is settling in now to a narrative that farmers are the problem and that national herd is the problem. Cows are a basic asset of a farm, of a business. We're not asking any other business to get rid of their assets and continue to do so.
All right,
but
I'm
agriculture
afraid.
Did increase. The emissions from agriculture
by
1.4%. Yes.
And 3% of that was attributed to fertiliser use, and the measures we're taking around reducing fertiliser use and to protect it,
guys,
is the right approach.
We ain't going to solve this one today, particularly because
we're
out of time, and the Angela still has to be played at 12 o'clock, no matter what views are held in this studio or not held. Eva McLeisett, Martin Hayden, Christina Finn and Roisin Shortall, thank you all very much for joining us this morning. Today's producer was Barbara Feeney. The series producer is Alistair O'Connell, research by Amy Ryan. Claire is going to be back with you on Monday. Have a good weekend. In the meantime, here's Ronan.